Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Italy and Spain are downgraded. Slovakia, my new favorite country. I'll tell you about that. Belgium is put on negative watch. And Portugal's banks are downgraded. We also have a lot to talk about the NFP report, you know, the jobs report. All this and lots more on episode number 233 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Xander Horowitz, and thanks for joining me. Thanks for all the great emails that you sent me regarding the various versions, the MP3 version and the enhanced version of the podcast that we put out last week. And it's kind of a split. A lot of the people who loved it, of course, have the various players or have been watching it on their computer, and they have access to see what's going on with the various graphics that we had put up. But there are those people, and that's fine, that just don't have the capability because their player doesn't play that type of file. So we're going to keep it on MP3s for a while, see how we can put this enhanced podcast together. And when we do, we will make sure that it will go out to as many people as possible. And we will always have, don't worry, we'll always have an MP3 version so that, of course, anybody can listen to it as an audio-only podcast. But there's a lot of things that I want to go over before we get to our guest today. We have some great guests. We have Harry Dent coming on today. He has a new book out called The Great Crash Ahead. And I don't know if that's going to be very uplifting, but I have a couple of questions that I want to ask him because a lot of people have written into me in the past and asked me to call him out on some of his recent market calls from a number of years ago, actually, and recently. So I'll ask him that. And then we have Larry Williams, the famous trader who has written dozens of books on the subjects of trading and how to do it right. So we'll talk about that, and I'll spend a few minutes first talking about the happenings that have gone on over the week and what to look out for over the next week or so. The economics that will be coming out will be, it's not really anything that's spectacular. We have some retail sales. We have some China numbers coming out on their inflation. That's important. But it wasn't like the last couple of weeks where we had some really important data that came out. And that's a good thing because the less data it seems, the better the markets can handle all the things that have gone on. We still have to contend with all the European issues. You know, over the weekend, we saw that Francis Sarkozy and Germany's Merkel said, hey, they are going to backstop or they're going to recapitalize the banks. Well, that's right after, of course, they take care of the Dexia situation, which was that bank in Belgium that is just went kerplunk. Now, I think the most fascinating thing about this, and I'll talk about how they actually are going to be putting this all together, was that it was only about three months ago, that there were the stress tests on the banks in Europe. And everybody passed besides a few in France and all that. And boy, everybody was so happy about that, weren't they? And Dexia passed and everything was fine. And 3 months later, they're going basically out of business. The amount of debt they have and the problems they have within the bank are just too much to bear, and they'd have to be taken over and basically nationalized. They're going to be split into a good bank, bad bank, meaning that you take all the toxic assets, the bad stuff, the ones that aren't paying, and you put them in one bank, essentially. And then on the other side, you have the good running bank. So you kind of hide all the bad stuff, and the government will actually, supposedly between France and Germany, are going to back this bank. They have to, because by letting this one go, it topples all the rest. You know, it's just a giant domino effect here. And this is the first. This is the first of this in this recent round, and it's a big one. The amount of assets they have far outweigh even the GDP of Belgium by, I don't know, 10 or more time multiple margin. And this is a very interesting situation because now that France is going to be backstopping them, I do wonder whether they're going to see a downgrade. Well, not Dexia, because we know they're downgraded. But the French sovereign, you have to wonder if what's going on with their banks and their entire financial situation, and by then throwing their hat in to back this bank, if one of the ratings agencies is going to come out and say, you know what, this is just a little bit too much with your involvement in the European Financial Rescue Fund and backing these banks and bailing these banks and trying to get, I mean, you know, this is really getting a little serious. There'll probably be a good amount of cheer and, you know, in the short term, and the banks will be all happy for a bit. But the reality is going to hit that the European region is really in big trouble. Now, let's talk for a moment about why I mentioned this whole issue of Slovakia. Slovakia is a small country. I mean, we're talking about 5 million people, 18,000 square miles. Now, as compared to the Eurozone in total, you know, they're really small. I mean, the Eurozone overall has, I don't know, 500 million people and about 1.6 million square miles. So think about how small this country is. Their GDP is just a midget compared to the rest of it. But this country is one of the 17 that's required to vote on the affirmative for the expansion of the European Financial Stability Fund, the EFSF. And what is really, I guess, kind of, I don't know, it's comical in a way, but boy, it's great. It's great if not just for theater. That Slovakia said, here's the deal, guys. We'll go along with this as long as you meet our conditions. First, we don't want to put any money into this deal. So we'll vote for it. You can do what you want over there, but we're not putting any money into it. We're not going to be on the hook. And there's also the dissenting party inside of the government that says, you know, if we do actually go forward with this, the current government is going to have to step down and we're going to take over. You just got to love this. So this little country basically is holding all the cards right now, them and Malta, for the establishment of the expansion of this fund in order to backstop many of the banks and to recapitalize, et cetera, and do all the things that supposedly they need to do. The truth is that the actual fund at its current size right now is far less than it's needed to, you know, really be there to backstop the banking system and the financial system. And whether or not Greece is going to get their money or not is another whole discussion. I will tell you that no matter what happens right now, that Europe will be moving into a recession. The United States, if all possible, we may, by the skin of our teeth, at least for another quarter or so, move aside from entering into a recession. We'll see what happens in a few months from now, how they call it. But the ECRI's numbers for their leading index of growth, et cetera, are just plummeting. And I know we saw the NFP number that looked good. It popped the futures and the markets up for a little while on Friday. But if you think about really what happened there, there was 45,000 already baked in from the returning Verizon workers. We know that. So when you see the actual trend and you kind of move the Verizon workers to last month and you take them out of this month's number, the trends are really not improving on the employment front. And even though we saw our ISM numbers doing better, you know, fact is they still are slowing down. So we're seeing slowdown all over the place between China, Asia. We're seeing the slowdown in Europe and in Brazil, India. And, you know, it is a global coordinated slowdown right now. Or maybe not coordinated, but it's a synchronized, I should say. So what we have to be looking for is how the markets are going to react to this Dexia issue, what is going to happen with the ratings agencies. The ratings agency, when they downgraded Italy and Spain on Friday, it really sunk the market here. So this is a big issue right now. And, you know, you have to remember that on top of all this, hedge funds right now have been really the most bearish they've been in a very long time. Their bets on the short side are mounting up dramatically. And that's probably what's causing some of these quick short cover swings and these big moves in the markets as players move in and out of their either commodity bets or their, you know, the bets on the market direction. So you have a very bearish hedge fund, the guys that are controlling the hot money, hedge funds that are controlling the money, that you have a significant amount of short bias. And on top of the short bias, you have a continuation of the liquidation trade. You're seeing commodities in the commitment of traders reports really moving lower and being sold. Now, on top of that, you see things like when you look at Paulson's funds, you know, he is the guy who made all that money during the housing bust. He was utilizing CDS exposure and betting against the housing and all that, billions of dollars. Well, his fund is his key fund, the Advantage Fund, which is leveraged and has a lot of gold in it, is down a whopping 47% year to date. 47%. And that's because of his large bets on gold, his leverage, and his bets on many of the banking stocks. I mean, look at these banking stocks. You know, Bank of America is at 50%. It's under 6. J.P. Morgan is just getting crushed. Goldman Sachs looks horrible. And, you know, we're going to see a lot of the beginnings of things next week because J.P. Morgan is going to be reporting. Google and Alcoa as well. But we'll see the J.P. Morgan report, and that should be an interesting tell as to what's going on with trading, which supposedly has pretty much dropped off a cliff. So earnings season is starting. The following week is when it really kicks up, and this is going to be the big, big finale, whether or not this market is going to hold up over this, we'll call it the 1150 area plus, or it's going to drop down to the projections of 950 or 1,000 or so when and if we are in a recessionary time. It's going to be the outlook. It's going to be the earnings that we see here. It's going to be the amount of earnings that we see that are generated by American-based, U.S.-based, domestic-based business and sales versus how much is from outside. But when you see that any individual stock chart, and take a look at some of these, it's amazing to see the steel companies, the materials companies, the oil and gas-related financials, they have just been obliterated, absolutely just chewed up and spit out. Their charts are, you know, off by 50% from their highs, many of them. And while it may not seem like the markets have gone down that much, you know, we clipped that bear market 20% last week on Tuesday at that low. So right now I'm going to continue recommending that there is a very, very, if you're going to do anything, just be careful. Do it light. Do it soft. Do it easy. Do it small. Because right now we're still in the midst of a very, very questionable time period. And that's why the line in the sand where you see this movement up and down and all around on a very, very quick basis on any news item is really causing major problems. You know, you see that, of course, things like the Sprint announcement that they're going to be buying all these iPhones and then they're going out to market to get more cash. Well, I mean, they want to buy like 30 million iPhones or some absurd number. Well, where are they going to get the cash from? Well, they're going to go out to market and get it. Yeah, meanwhile, the stock's down 20% just on that news. They're going to stop using the whole Clearwire network. Well, that stock's down 30% on that news. So there's a lot of very, very, I would say, itchy fingers on the sell button right now as opposed to on the buy button. The volume that we see is not leaning towards the upside at all. You know, you're seeing the continue of liquidation. And then they let off for a little while and then say, okay, you know, let the markets come up, let the markets breathe, and then we'll come back in for some selling in a little while. The only thing that you have going for you right now in terms of market potential is two things. Well, three things. You have the European resolution, which I just can't get in my head how that's actually going to take place. And we're going to see a great and a long-term outcome that's just happy, happy. The second thing is earnings. We need to see earnings that are going to meet or exceed the lowered estimates, revenues that come in reasonably well, and outlook, guidance. And then I think finally it's going to be what happens with, you know, not only the economics, but, you know, the dollar in that whole area, because right now the dollar's been on the rise. Now, all that is going to be, once again, involved with the sector rotation trade that usually have a good market condition towards the end of the year. You have a performance chase. Managers will reallocate, and they want to be, you know, neutral with the markets. They don't want to lose out on anything. So that is part of this trade also. All that together means that there's a lot of opposing forces that are right now in the market. And what that does is it creates this incredible tension and this incredible volatility. So don't be spooked. Just kind of sit on the sideline and watch what happens. Watch till we get a leveling off and whether it's going to be the next move down because we're starting to get a little bit more of a narrower range in the markets or it's going to go up and then play that direction. All right, so a couple more things I want to mention. Stocktoberfest is going on, and hopefully you've been there. You've checked it out. We have a lot of stocks up. A lot of stocks are failing because their technicals look pretty awful. And realize that you have not only the technicals, but the market condition that goes into some of this. So the market condition is in a strong downtrend, if you didn't know. And, you know, the technicals look pretty bad, too. So you're getting a really poor technical score that's really, really skewing the whole total score, which is both technical and fundamental. But all month we're going to be doing this. You wrote me all of the stocks that you want to see, and we put together all of the analysis, and it goes up with the latest on a daily basis over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Also, you can follow that and follow everything over at Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is my handle, if you will. And that will actually give you all the updates very regularly because it hits Twitter as soon as we blog it. And then finally, I think we want to mention, there was one more thing I want to mention somewhere in here. We talked about Dexia. Okay, we talked about this. I got all my notes. Belgium NFP report, we mentioned that. Belgium was negative. Okay, fine. All right, well, I guess we're in good shape over there now. I'll mention also that this episode is sponsored by GoToMeeting. And GoToMeeting is one of those wonderful, wonderful products, really, that just makes your life a lot easier. You can simply log on to GoToMeeting, and you can share your screen with anybody, have an online meeting, and save a lot of time and money and energy, and you don't have to go anywhere. That's the beauty of it all. So it's really convenient. It's really easy. We love using it because we can meet with a client and simply just share things, and we can have an online and a virtual conversation, if you will, with the voice over IP option and spend some time on really talking about things versus, you know, spending time traveling back and forth. So you can get your own free trial, this 30-day free trial, over at GoToMeeting.com. You just put in the code podcast in there. That's GoToMeeting.com, a great service that you really should check out. If you haven't done it, you get to play with it for 30 days free. GoToMeeting.com/podcast. So then let's get right to Harry Dent, good friend of mine for a long time. He's written some fabulous books. He has a new one out, and I thought it would be a really good time to get his opinion on what is actually happening with regard to the economies around the world, et cetera. Harry, how are you?
Good, good.
So let's kind of go through a couple of different things. And you have a new book out, by the way. What's it called?
It's called The Great Crash Ahead.
The Great Crash Ahead, which is kind of... do you think we're in the middle of it, by the way? Are we in the middle of that?
Yeah, I think it basically already started. I think stocks topped in very late April, along with commodities. And this is kind of like we're in the first wave down. And then you get a bounce, probably. I think we're going to go a little lower. And then we get a bounce late in the year, and everybody thinks everything's okay again. And then the crash just keeps resuming. You know, Europe keeps failing, and the U.S. stimulus, you know, keeps failing at some point. But I think the fourth quarter is going to be stronger than people think at first. So that's in between now and then. We probably get a rally before the crash gets more serious next year.
Well, but let's talk about that for a second, and let's talk about your thesis on why the fourth quarter would be good. So here we are, and we're in the beginning of October, and it looks like, I mean, just if you wanted to step back, that everything seems to be falling apart. Asia is just not happy. Emerging markets aren't happy. And Europe is a disaster du jour, except for the fact that they're sugarcoating everything, it seems, from their the various mouthpieces. So what is going to push the economy better, and is it isolated to the U.S.?
Yes, it would be isolated to the U.S. I agree. Europe is weakening. I mean, austerity only forces their economies to slow down more. Then their deficit gets worse. Then their debt crisis comes back. I mean, so this is going to continue. And Asia, China is slowing down. They're having to slow down their economy because of rising inflation. And that's hitting commodity prices. So, you know, copper's down like 30 or 40% now. So yeah, that's happening. In the U.S., we particularly show... We have an internet indicator called the Daily Growth Index, measures real-time spending on the internet. And it's saying consumers have been starting to spend again, especially the younger consumers there who've been very cautious since late May. And that gives about a four-month lead time. So it says the economy ought to start to show a little more strength, you know, right here around October. It'll probably be weeks before we get any indicators that show that. So we may get the end of whatever bad news we're going to get with this non-farm payroll report, or it may even be a little better than expected. But we're looking at next month to see if statistics pick up. But right now, just the jobless claims would suggest we're not going into a recession yet. I mean, we think we ultimately will because the baby boomers, you know, they kind of hit their peak in spending in 2007, kind of right on track. But they're in what we call the plateau phase between age 46 and 50. Starting in 2012, they start to move into the decline phase where the kids are fully out of the nest and then their spending drops off more and their savings rises more aggressively. So I think the stimulus programs are going to start to fail more starting sometime in 2012, probably sooner than later.
Yeah, Bernanke actually said that he doesn't see much more firepower in stimulus. And obviously, I think everybody agrees that we need a little bit more fiscal policy if there is such a thing that can help, versus just a monetary policy. But, you know, I'll tell you another thing that just sparked my thought process here. We put out an analysis that looked at a And we look at, you know, different comparisons and what moves what. And we did a look at the rise and fall of consumer credit. Now, that's a little bit, the reports come out a little bit delayed. But we looked at that, and then we offset that by about 6 months because we found an interesting correlation between the increase in consumer loans and you know, credit card loans and consumer credit outstanding to the markets about 6 months later. And if you did look at that, we came up a couple, like maybe 6 months ago, with the idea that it could be September, October, and probably late October that you could see a bounce. So that kind of interestingly goes along with your thesis.
Yeah, I think this will be short-lived, and like you say, it's the U.S. only. So, you know, Europe's going to keep causing problems. I mean, we started the last crisis with our subprime crisis. We have the most private debt in the world by far. But Europe has the biggest sovereign debt problems, government debt problems, you know, after Japan. And so, you know, we see it kind of, Europe keeps melting down, then the U.S. starts melting down, and then China gets hit in its exports to Europe and U.S., And China has an incredible bubble. I mean, they're just building cities for millions, nobody in them, excess capacity in industry, roads and railways. They're just building tons of stuff. People don't realize the consumers used to be 70% of their economy, like us, you know, decades ago. Now their consumers are 36% of their economy. Over 50% is just the government building stuff. That's unsustainable.
So when you look at the, you know, potential for a crash, what are you talking about? Is it a global? What exactly are you saying?
Yeah, it is global. It's like 2008 and 9, where everything goes down except the U.S. dollar. And Treasury bonds, maybe they're not. Everybody's already piled into Treasury bonds. But, yeah, it is a global crash. But it's also really been precipitated more than anybody by the Fed. The Fed has put trillions of dollars into the banking system, QE1, QE2. Literally just to keep the banks alive, just gave money to the banks. The banks turn around and reinvest it and speculate since they're not lending because consumers and businesses don't want to borrow more. They're too much in debt, and banks are much more picky about who they lend to now. They're not lending it. They're speculating, and then, of course, along with hedge funds at high leverage, and all the Fed has done is created a third bubble. Stocks doubled in 2 years. Hey, it took them 5 years to double from 2002, 2007. You know, gold, silver, commodities. We said in the last book, The Great Depression Ahead, that gold and silver would be the last bubble. And they are. And silver's already peaked at 50. Gold has probably peaked at 1934, may make one more run up to 2000. But we think commodities, which have already peaked, especially copper, all these things are going down together. That's the problem. There's nowhere to hide when real estate, stocks around the world, and commodities are down at the same time.
Yeah.
Fed pushed them all up, now they all go down. I mean, how often do you see gold, silver, oil, commodities, and stocks going up at the same time? The answer is almost never.
Right.
And for no period of time, Fed has pushed everything up, and they sit there and say, oh, we're not affecting commodity prices. I just don't see how we possibly can. You know, I mean, they are desperate. You
right.
know, they're like a rat, you know, in a cage, you know, threatened. They're doing anything to get the people to feel better and to keep the economy going, and it's not working. And, you know, we're not getting a sustainable recovery, and all we're getting is a bubble, and bubbles have to burst. So that's why the great crash ahead. I mean, it's a similar theme to the Great Depression ahead, but we really look at how these bubbles have formed and how they now have to come down.
Yeah. I need to ask you something. I've gotten a lot of emails many times that you've been on, and I haven't talked to you about this, but there's been a question about, hey, you know, this guy Harry Denny comes on, he talks about a variety of different things and seems logical and everything, but, you know, he wrote this book or this thesis back when Dow 30,000, was it 30,000? What was it?
Yeah, 32,000.
32,000, like, why should we believe him now?
Tell them they're idiots.
Okay, hold on a second, you're idiots.
Yeah, you're idiots. We called every major turn that nobody saw. We saw the fall of Japan in the late 80s when economists said they were going to surpass the U.S. economy, which was demographically impossible. We call the boom of the 90s when everybody was calling depression and the end of U.S. growth. We call the top in the real estate bubble. We talked in 2005. We got people into stocks 2002. Yes, we were predicting a second bubble in the Roaring 2000s book that would be just as big as the first one, and we were wrong about that. We were wrong about the magnitude. It was simply because the bubble shifted to real estate, commodities, gold, silver, oil, and emerging markets like China, Russia. These countries went up 600 to 1,000%, even more than tech stocks. So we didn't anticipate unlike the past in the early 1900s when we saw a double bubble in tech stocks. We didn't anticipate the bubble just totally shifting to new areas, and it did. So the book was the Roaring 2000s. We had the greatest concerted global bubble in history. We had people in stocks, and U.S. stocks only doubled instead of quadrupled. I'm sorry. We made a damn mistake.
Yeah,
you don't listen to us because of that, you're an idiot.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, I appreciate your tact. I appreciate
people
that.
People say they always criticize economists. They never take a position. They couch everything. Well, if this, if that. We make bold forecasts, and when we're wrong, we change our research, we update stuff. But we make one major mistake, only in magnitude, in the right direction, and people crucify us. I've answered this question 5,000 times.
Yeah.
If you don't get that, you're just an idiot. Go listen to somebody else.
Yeah.
Who else has forecast all these key changes? We forecast this downturn 20 years ago. Who the hell can do that?
Yeah, I hear you. Well, let's have a sip of your tea. Relax. We're going to go on to another thing. I want to take that power and I want to direct it somewhere else. What do you think about generally economists? How it seems that they update their information on a after the fact basis, and it's getting quite troubling. That I agree with you that the predictions are, you know, penguin like.
Well, it's all if the Fed does this, if that. We said from the beginning the Fed's going to fail. You can't fight 92 million baby boomers who've switched now from being spenders and borrowers to savers. You can't fight that. Old people want to save money. They want to pay down debt. They don't want to buy a bigger house. They don't buy and drive cars as often because they're old people, and that's what old people do. So they're trying to turn around the U.S. economy in a time when the baby boom generation needs to be saving for retirement, not spending and borrowing more money. So the very premise of what they're doing, they don't understand the very economy and the consumers in it, because they frankly don't think consumers matter.
Yeah, let's just shift to Japan. This is a pet peeve of mine. You know, one of the things I don't really understand about Japan is, you know, we see their debt to GDP and their amount of debt outstanding is just out of control. We see they have an aging population. This actually, you know, by the way, time out. Recently, you know, you and I have talked about the whole issue, and you really got me started on the whole demographics discussion. It was actually kind of cool. My kid going to school, and they did the age distribution charts, you know, the pyramids.
Yeah.
It was kind of cool. I'm like, hey, look at that, you know, but that they were teaching in school. Bill Gross comes out with an interesting piece, something about my six-pack, he called it, which the first two paragraphs were about his six-pack and his buttocks, which I think was a little bit long to then go into what he was why he was referring to that. But and the thought of Bill Gross's buttocks, I had to skip through that paragraph, you know? But now he talks about a few key things. One of them is the idea that the emerging markets have created a hollowing of the developed markets, which is your thesis on, I think, a little bit about aging and a bit of an S-curve, you know, like where the innovation is going to go to and how it's going to change. But he also talked about the whole idea that, you know, this aging population. So you skip over to Japan. I mean, how are they still resilient, and I don't even understand.
Well, you know, there's two things. I mean, the developed countries are all aging. That's number one. And number two, emerging countries are rising and competing in a lot of our basic industries and jobs, especially manufacturing. These jobs are moving overseas. You got corporations growing at high rates, but jobs not growing here. So those are two trends that have occurred and will continue to occur. Japan, to me, has done all the wrong things. They have constantly stimulated their economy. They never let the private debt and the real estate bubble fully deleverage so their consumers and private sectors are carrying too much debt. The government debt through stimulus has eased the pain, and now they got 240% of GDP in government debt, which would bankrupt them except for one little simple fact. They pay 1% interest on that debt, long-term
right.
even. And Japanese have been savers, heavy savers. They bought their own country's debt. They've been in an off and on deflationary period, so it's kept interest rates real low. Now, their population is aging now faster than anyone in the world, and you know Greece and all those Southern Europe are next in the totem pole. But they're aging now to the point where they're getting too many people who are in the spending down savings mode in retirement. Once people retire, they start spending down their savings, so their savings are plummeting. and they're going to go negative in the next maybe 3 to 5 years. And when Japan has to do like us and go to the international markets for money, they're going to have to pay higher interest rates, mm-hmm. 3%, ultimately 4% or 5%. So ultimately, Japan's basically bankrupt. They're, yeah. I call them a retirement home in hock. and people should notice their real estate, their stock market, their economy really hasn't recovered 20 years later. They peaked the beginning of 1990, actually 22 years later at this point. Real estate peaked in 1991, dropped 60%, has never bounced. Stocks dropped over 80%, has barely bounced. So Japan is not the model of what countries should do. They need to be addressing their aging crisis. Either you got to have more kids or you got to attract immigrants, and mm-hmm. they're not doing either. And you can't keep running up debt with an aging population because the entitlement pressures are just going to rise, just like they're rising for the U.S., but Japan's got the worst demographics in the world. So they're not going anywhere.
Yeah, so let's wrap it up with this. What is your number one biggest concern? What is the number one tipping point or the biggest thing that you're focusing on? I know I have, like, France, for example, is really a concern of ours, and watching what happens with their banks, because it really seems to be that Europe is wagging the entire, not only the dog, the entire dog population at this point. What is your biggest concern that's really going to push us into the next level, in your opinion, that you're saying is going to be a crash?
Well, again, yeah, I think it gets precipitated more by Europe. Like you say, now they've worried about Italy. Well, the next is France, because all this debt keeps backing up. And then it'll be Germany at some point. Germany can't shoulder this whole thing. They're the only solid country over there in finances. So I think Europe is what tips us, keeps, well, it has. Every time we've had a major stock correction, including now, the theme has been Europe. Yeah, okay, U.S. slower than expected, but that hasn't been what's really roiled the market. It has been news about Europe. And then the biggest thing, which people don't see on the flip side, is we see China taking a big stumble this time. They don't just slow down. They take a stumble and their bubble bursts. They have the most expensive real estate in the world, the greatest overbuilding bubble in history, and that's going to be the surprise, because when China goes down, that takes down the emerging world, because all the emerging countries are exporting materials and energy to China's unbelievable, crazy building boom.
Yeah, and actually that's been occurring. And you know what's really interesting, Harry? I don't know, but back in 2008, everything was kind of coming down, and it was, I guess it was newer, the velocity and the moves and the numbers, you know. But you know, the banks out there, they're down 50%. A lot of the material stocks are down 50-60% in the last, well, we'll say year to date. And it has a different kind of feel, because the markets haven't really been as devastated as they were. So I guess that's a little bit of a, I guess people are thinking, well, maybe it's not so bad. But if you look around the world, it's ugly out there.
Yeah, it's ugly, but I mean, the markets, I think, are kind of a little dumb here. I mean, they keep thinking that governments can solve this problem. They know it's challenging, but they keep thinking, well, Europe, you know, every time Europe comes with a new plan, they go, okay, now we can rally again. I mean, like I said earlier, are you born yesterday? I mean, the European problem, demographics say, and the austerity programs say, the European problem can only get worse. That everybody's hoping the economy is going to return back to normal with enough stimulus. With aging demographics in all the developed countries, especially strongly in Southern Europe, these economies are not coming back. They're not going to be better 2-3 years from now. They're only going to be worse. Same in the United States. Demographics only says the economy is going to be weaker years ahead. So everybody hoping if the Fed can just stimulate it long enough for us to reignite sustainable growth, it's just not going to happen. So sooner or later, the markets are going to figure this out, and they're going to crash.
And I'll tell you something, you know, I've said this 100 times, and I think this is a really good point to say this. And whether or not the markets go up or down, the one strategy that I think is probably the most often used and most incorrectly used and should never actually be used is the strategy of hope.
Yes.
Hope.
Hope is not a strategy.
It's not a strategy. It's not a strategy. It's something that if you want to, in the background, deal with it, but don't utilize that for implementation. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, Harry, tell us where we can get your book.
Best is, Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. That's the way to get it the quickest, and they've got very good prices. They always discount new books that are selling well. So Barnes and Noble bookstores tend to most feature our books. So
right.
If you want to go to a bookstore, I'd say go to Barnes and Noble.
Yeah. Actually, I got some interesting, I wrote a nice piece for your book, and I saw a bunch of news people sent me information, oh, thanks for the write-up or whatever, and I didn't even know what they were talking about at the moment, at that second. Then I had to realize what was going on. And also, you have a subscription service, I know, for the market calls in terms of, the monthly and quarterly economics.
We have a monthly newsletter with, you know, daily updates when necessary by email called HS Dent Forecast. You can get a free sample of that on our website, hsdent.com.
Okay, great. Harry Dent, the great Harry Dent. I want to thank you for, number one, clearing up that if there is any doubt that you made the call incorrectly, it was just in the magnitude, not in direction. So it went up instead of going up 100%, it only went up 50%. Oh, pity, pity. Then at the same time, you're saying, hey, maybe the fourth quarter looks like there's a potential last gasp, we'll call it, of the economy. And then from there, we go to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, you know, and say that last gasp could really handcuff the Fed, because if the fourth quarter is stronger and inflation keeps edging up, it's already 3% in Canada, U.S., and Europe. That's going to start saying, the Fed's going to have to start saying, oh my gosh, you know, we can't stimulate anymore. Inflation's getting up 4% or higher. And if they stop stimulating on a lag, this economy's dead. Without stimulus, this economy would have already been dead. That should be obvious.
Yeah, no question about that. But that's the rule. And I think the last thing that I'm going to say on this topic is, when you talk about stimulus and economies and governments, I was really hoping in that government shutdown that the answer would have been that everything stays, but we just temporarily, 4 months, 3 months, shut down Congress. Because it seems every time they're around, they're meddling.
Well, the markets love it when the Congress is in stalemate or doing nothing.
Yeah, doing nothing is so much better. Yeah, I hear you. Harry Dent, thanks for joining me on the Discipline Investor Podcast.
Okay.
I'll talk to you. Bye-bye. Next up, as I promised you, we have Larry Williams, and he is, you can find him at ireallytrade.com. He is a gent who has written, if you go look at his website, I mean, just a lot of books. I mean, The Right Stock for the Right Time, Day Traders and Futures Online, Long-Term Secrets and Short-Term Trading. And this is in Japanese and American, and it goes on and on. So we're pretty pleased and honored that we can have Larry, who's a well-known and world-renowned, we'll call him short-term trader, and we're going to, Larry, I am going to find out from you what's going on. What do you say?
Well, you know, there's always a bull market someplace and always a bear market someplace, but I think the overriding message right now to investors is a real old adage: when the president's in trouble, the market's in trouble.
Mm.
And I think that is going to be the underwriting tone of this market until we figure out the politics of what's going on. And the president obviously has some problems. The market's going to be this erratic run-up, run-down, run-up, back-and-forth trading affair.
So let's talk about that. That's interesting. So let's talk about, you got to run up, and then you got to run down, right? So there's got to be, obviously, multiple sides of the discussion. There's a side that says, oh, it's great price, I'm buying it. You know, all those people that talk about cheapness and, you know, value stocks. And then you got the people that are selling it or shorting it or whatever's going on. Is this two different groups, or is it sort of like just a group of traders that are just bobbing and swaying to, you know, within certain ranges?
Well, yeah, I like that analogy. If you can just visualize, I'm looking out at the ocean here in St. Croix, and I'm looking at the ocean. You see a bunch of little bobbers bobbing up and down, and they're back and forth. The wave isn't doing anything. But once the wave really picks up, then they all start to move in a direction. Right now, they're back and forth on up and down.
But yeah.
Once we get to a cyclical time period, which I think is coming up, by the way, then I think we're going to see the market move in unison and be able to establish a trend. At the end of October, somewhere in that area, that's where the cycles come in to kick this thing out of this back and forth, everyone wondering. The bulls are happy one day, they're sad the next day. But you really need the cyclical time element to factor in here.
So just to kind of set this up, what is your general outlook? I'm just talking about from now to the end of the year, and let's even go to when the cycle changes and there is a trend. What is your baseline thesis on the direction?
Well, definitely up.
Yeah. Okay.
I've been bearish on this. You know, a year ago, our forecast was for the market to make a high June 21st or 22nd, and a significant buy point in October around the 18th of the month. And this low we just made, we may retest it, we may hold back in there, maybe in a trading range, but we should sort of come out of this zone around the middle to the end of October. So that's a buy point for a really nice rally. I think goes into April 12th based on the charts you provided. with your yield curve, because that yield curve, Andrew, that's just such a marvelous predictor of tops in the stock market in the future. So I think that's
how do you use that? So everybody can understand, when you're looking at a yield curve, which the yield curve of the Treasuries and the from the short term to the long term, and it kind of looks at, well, you can look at a variety of things of how it's changed over time or just what it is. How do you use that then to predict?
Well, if you look at your charts, and everybody's got to love your charts so much. I don't know if they like you, but we love your charts.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Now we love them both. But if you look at the yield curve chart, you'll notice that when it peaks, 2 years later, the stock market peaks.
Mm-hmm.
And that just had a really good record of doing that. And it peaked April 2010, had 2 years to that, at April 2012. It peaked on the low. It came down into a low of April 2007 to add 2 years to that, March 2009. What a spectacular place to be a buyer in the market.
Interesting.
So, you know, it peaked December 2000, so December 2002. You're right at the lows of the market when we started the whole last big bull market that we saw. So I think that it has some predictive ability, and I think we're up between now and into April 2012, and then let's see what happens.
So, you know, I think that we, I think from what you're saying, I think the predictor is all about how the low interest rates work their way in over time. Would that be true?
Yeah, that there's an, you know, there's an explosion of money supply, lower interest rates, whatever. But that doesn't immediately change Main Street business tomorrow, because it doesn't filter down. Guys don't believe it. They can't get the money from their bank yet. The bank's unwilling to lend them. It takes a while to get the engine up and running, to get the gasoline from the tank in out of the pump, which is where it is, into the engine. And that's about a two-year factor when you look at the yield curve.
Mm-hmm. If there was no such thing as Europe, would we be in the same situation now?
Yeah.
We would.
My belief is it doesn't matter who's president now, he'd have troubles, because the cycles have been really negative on the market starting in June of this year and will continue negative, on a very long-term basis, until probably 2014. We're going to have some nice up moves, like I said, between end of this month and end of April, and another rally coming later on. But this is not a great economic growth cycle that we're in, so it's fitting to see all this stuff happen. This is what you'd expect based on what cycles in the past have done.
You know, I spend a lot of time. I've talked with cycles with a couple of different people. A good friend of mine, John C. Dvorak, he talks about cycles, and the word cycles come up a lot. And you know what? Could you just spend a moment and tell me and tell all of us what exactly, I mean, you know, what kind of cycles? You don't have to give away secrets, but what are you talking about?
Well, I think there's the common misperception is a track I went down starting in 1963, I guess, into 1978 or so, is that tops and bottoms occur 21 months apart, 9 years apart, whatever. And so if that's true, we'd all make money in the market. We'd all know there's a low 4 years from now and a high 10 years from the last high. That doesn't work. But what I found does work is I can ferret out the cycles. Let's say there's a 9-week and there's definitely a 13-week cycle in bonds and a 26-week cycle in bonds. Then I put all those together, and that gives me a pretty good forecast when bonds will top bottom. It's not going to be to the day. Sometimes it is, but you can't bank on that. But it gives a good roadmap of when the major trends start and up and down. So it's not a repetitive of 28 days, because these cycles weave in and out. But it's basically a measure of time of when good things and bad things happen in a market.
And this is regardless of who's at the helm making the rules, who's driving the car, what roadblocks are put in front, this is just going to happen?
Yeah, it seems to be that way. I mean, that's a little cosmic thinking. But I don't know what else to think after doing it all these years and seeing some of these calls in the markets. I look at them and say, this is scary to me, and I'm the one who made it. So how could possibly be that precise to call the high in the Japanese yen or the low in the dollar index? I shake my head. I don't understand it. So all I can say is that the cycles are there, and the human emotions Now, I think it's all based on the 10-year solar cycle, which is not quite 11 years. And that was first written about 100 years ago. But that has had a real strong impact on the economy and on production of grains and meats and mining and everything. And I think that's the underlying what it's about.
Interesting. I got to be honest with you. I'm not taking anything away from you. And even if you are the best investor in the world using these things, I still have a hard time getting my head around it. But
took me a long time to, and it certainly isn't the only thing I use.
Right, no, obviously, yeah.
You know, as you mentioned, I've written some books, but I trade quite a bit. And the cycles to me are like, okay, I'm in the time zone now. Buy signals will work better. Sell signals will work better. But I just like seasonals or so much of this stuff. I mean, you know, as a professional, you wait till you get a preponderance of evidence before you say the dirty dog's guilty. You can't just take thing and put on a trade.
So let's talk about what you are trading. Are you using more futures and in that kind of environment?
Or? I run a small stock fund, which is based on fundamentals in the Dow. We are always long in certain stocks in the Dow or flat. We're currently flat. We're about to go long. We got flat earlier in the year, and so we sidestepped this last decline, but we buy value stocks, and I rate a value-weighted measure to determine the best value-rated stocks in the Dow. That's the fund. Then my personal trading is futures and not much stocks, just futures.
Now, the futures market is very interesting because, if you look at the S&P futures as an example, they are, or the NAS futures, whatever, you know, you take a few days ago, and if you saw what happened when the night that Steve Jobs had passed away, the NAS futures were down something like, 15, 18 immediately. And there was a fair value calculation. By the time you turned around, it was like down 1.5%. Okay? If you just went to sleep before that and woke up, it's like nothing ever happened. They're quickly moving. They're moving overnight. They're a lot thinner. Do you trade them overnight or do you trade them intraday?
Well, I do trade futures at night, but not often. What I usually do, I'm in Eastern Standard Time Zone, so I'll put my orders in, 8, 9 o'clock tonight, and then they stay there. I mean, I know where my buy stops are. I know what's going to get me long or short of market. And for the exact reason you pointed out, I think that the people trying to day trade, it's a nightmare because you've got one dead man zone from basically now until 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning. We might get a big breakout, you might not, and it's very erratic action. So I don't follow the market much during the day. We just came off the water and off our boat and came back and see how the markets ended up for the day. I think you look too close at these markets, you can't see what's really going on.
Yeah,
you try to catch little trends instead of big trends. The money's in big trends.
No, I hear you. Hey, I have a question for you. I have noticed a irregularity in something, and I really didn't look into it too deeply, but I think maybe you're the guy to ask. So we have named the fellow that seems to awaken at 2 a.m. every morning, or maybe he gets at 1:30, but he starts his day at 2 o'clock in the morning, the 2 a.m. bandit. You could have the euro crashing or, moving up, or you could have silver or gold or oil. Somehow at 2 o'clock, there's a magical bid or a sell. I mean, right then and there. To some ridiculous amount, reversing the trend quite often. Now, we tried to find out, all right, what stock market opened that maybe would work. I couldn't find. So do you have any idea what's going on with the 2 a.m. bandit?
No. I did look at that in your study, and I can't find it universally across markets. So it may be a person or a group of people that are beating up on one market, and then maybe they move on to another market. I think, though, what is significant in the market is it really begins in Australia.
Right.
And that's the first major market that opens up. A nice key off of Australia. And then from Australia, we come on around the globe, and then we're in South Africa, and then we're in the DAX in Germany and the FTSE, and then we get to America. So it may have something to do with that, because the 2 o'clock time in Sydney is going to be our time here, 14 hours. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, because at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, too. Have you noticed, by the way, this trend of on the hour, the push of the market? It's almost like a test.
you know, since I don't look at it in a day, I don't know.
You can look on a chart. It's very interesting. There's like this test and says if they, I think it's like if they pick up on it, hey, great. If not, we'll move on. So let's talk about the bigger picture. You know, you say that there could be a rally. The economics that are in the background, what is your thoughts on this and how that's going to affect things? Aside from, I got to say, from what I'm hearing, it doesn't matter. You know, we could actually, you know, have something either terrible or terrific happen, and pretty much the cycle is going to be the cycle, right? But putting that aside, what do you think about the economic backdrop?
Well, first of all, I'm no economist. I'm a trader. And so all I know is about the same as anybody else knows. And what I have found is when I start believing somebody or seeing something at work, it stops working.
Yeah.
So, I trade what's in front of me, Andrew, and I think at this precise moment right now, there is somebody who is bearish as all get out, and if you listen to him, it sounds absolutely believable, and there's somebody equally bullish with the same economic data, and it sounds equally believable. So, I mean, you know, I've been doing this for 50 years, and I've seen that pattern so much. I finally, you know, forget all these guys.
Yeah.
What matters is the trend of the market. Is it a fundamentally strong stock if I'm going to have it in my fund? Is it a value stock, or does it not represent value? Value may be delayed, but it's not denied. Value will be rewarded at some point.
So you like buying on dips then in that? Is that, I mean, that's the concept where it comes down and you'll pick it up more?
Well, yeah, at times. You know, my ideal scenario is I'm going to find the time when it's right to be in the market.
Mm-hmm.
Because, let's say, there should be a cyclical or a seasonal low, either one of those, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to have a little confirmation that there's some accumulation coming in the market. And I want to buy value. If I'm buying value at the right time in the stock market, I will be rewarded.
Right.
I bought thousands of shares of Annaly Mortgage yesterday, 15. Because it's a pretty good time to buy the stock. It got crashed, it came, it hit down real big, and now bounces right back up. So a lot of this stuff is just, you know, doing this, and like you, and you see, you go, oh, yeah, I know, the butler killed him. I've seen this play before.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a lot of it, I think, and that's why it's very difficult to do what we do. It's so filled full of so many emotions. One day you made a lot of money, the next day you give some of it back. You're never right about what you're doing in this business. On my winning trades, I never had enough. My losing trades already had too many contracts on. It's not an easy business.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, by the way, so you bought Annaly on the drop a little bit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You could thank me for that. You could thank me. Do you even know why?
Oh, really? Thank you. Why?
Well, it's probably, I'm saying that tongue in cheek, but just 2 days ago, we put up a, in our Stocktoberfest, Annaly was one of the first ones that we analyzed. And of course, one of the big things is the trend of the markets that go into the big technical picture. And we gave it a pretty much thumbs down right now for a position. That was, of course, it's a day, you know, when we do a snapshot report, we look at fundamentals and we look at technicals. And the problem is that most technicals look like absolute crap right now.
You're right.
So
yeah, they do.
So it's detracting from any score that looks anything even reasonable. But if you, you know, look at the fundamentals and technicals of Annaly, it came out, you know, a giant red a couple of days ago. And it was kind of interesting because I was like, right after that, the stock took a nice nosedive, and I thought, oh, my.
Yeah, it just collapsed. But I think, you know, if there's a stock that's yielding 16%,
right,
there's
right.
a lot of us going like, hey, come to me, baby. Come
right.
bite my book.
Right.
Like fly fishing. And so that was a reason. Like, you know, where can you get a yield like that?
Yeah.
Even if they cut their dividend a little bit, I mean, still, that's a great yield.
Yep. All right, so let's talk, though, about if people want to visualize the concept of, you know, this idea of trading and, you know, doing, you know, a little bit more in this condition. The ranges right now are very difficult. Daily, intraday, weekly, I don't care, whatever you want to call. How does that set up in the big picture for you?
Well, it's critical because ranges to me represent potential risk. Let's just say I buy at the high of a day. I'm always buying high of day. I'm not, but let's just assume that. And my stop was a lower that day. Well, a couple of years ago in soybeans, that meant my risk was $200. And now it might be $1,500. Or
mm-hmm.
in silver, it might be $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that dictates to me how large my position can be relative to the portfolio or the balance of my account. And some markets that can't be traded by the average guy now. because the average guy got maybe $20,000-$30,000 account, and he could lose $10,000 in silver because the ranges are so large. He's either got to go to ETFs, mini contracts, or something. It really takes it away from some great markets because the average guy can't trade the large range of markets. He's got to come up with something like ETFs or another strategy.
Now, I was really curious about the mysterious drops of gold and silver and a few other things over the last several months. When at the end of the day, the CME comes out with an announcement that they're increasing the margin requirements, right? And it's my understanding that the CME would publish that sometime in the afternoon after they close, and they close earlier than the regular markets, the pits and all that. But then you have the electronic trading, of course. But what I found fascinating was that you had this gigantic drop during the day. So therefore, there was a kind of a distance between what was happening, what was supposed to be knowledge of the public, but then the release at the end of the day. Wasn't there something fishy about that?
Well, yeah, really fishy. I think that that's one point to be made. But the grander point, I don't understand the logic of the people at the exchanges, because we know that if I want to increase liquidity, I decrease prices.
Mm-hmm.
If I want more players in the market, I want to sell more widgets, I drop the price from $1 to 10 cents, and I'll have more buyers. So if you want liquidity in silver, why wouldn't you lower the margin? Because if you raise the margin, you just cut out the liquidity.
Or
that's what they've always done. It makes no economic sense to me at all.
Or on the other hand, they raise it, they shake out people and do a massive amount of trading to get the fees.
Yep.
And then they lower it down eventually, like they just recently. You know, they just recently lowered down the S&P 500 contracts.
Yeah, and those tend to be significant points. Part of all this problem, was off point, but not too much. When you and I were kids, there, in my hometown, Billings, Montana, there were two television stations. Then we had three.
Right.
And that was about all we could handle. Well, right now, there's you can get, 150 television stations on
Of them have nothing on them. But go ahead.
And it's the same, and it's the same thing with what to trade.
Right.
It used to be there are three or four things to trade, and Andrew, now there's 9,000 things I can trade, 10,000. I go to China and Australia, there's 40,000 things I can trade. It's really hard to get focus. It's like there's so many TV stations you don't know what to watch tonight. There's so many things to trade. So traders lose focus. They don't know where to be. They're hopscotching all over the place.
So I guess the message in there is if you're going to trade, and not different than investing, but trading, that maybe probably the best advice is to focus in on a select group that you can track, understand, maybe get to know their dance, if you will. And, because I know that if you focus in on a particular stock, you know, hey, you know what, this stock seems to always bounce on its 50-day moving average and da-da-da-da-da, and you know that when there's lack of liquidity, it means this. And, I mean, you can make a story, you know, you can make the trend and you can watch it more closely. But back to the futures market, it is very disturbing. And by the way, I was able to have a conversation with Gary Gensler a few weeks ago, and I cornered him and I asked him, I don't know if you heard this interview, but I asked him, I said, you know, let me ask you a question, about the silver and gold movement and the fact that the CMA released it at the end of the day, and I don't understand how that happens, and this is not the first. And you know what he said to me?
Mm.
I'm not familiar with that incident.
Nah.
Okay, and then he said their oversight is more focused on government issues, like government release of data early from, let's say, corn. On the harvest and what happens there. And I was very much struck by how incredibly ridiculous this whole thing is.
Well, go back to the Hunt Brothers fiasco.
Right.
Where the members of the exchange couldn't meet margin calls in a short position, so they called the median exchange members, they increased the margin, and they shook Hunt Brothers out of it, which eventually led to their bankruptcy. So the exchanges are a club. I mean, this is not a government-run organization.
Yeah.
Not that government could do any better.
Yeah.
But you have to keep that in mind, that if they want to shake people out, they know how to do it.
Yeah, and it seems like
a message, like they're ringing a bell. Hey, we just increased margin to $30,000 in silver. Well, duh.
Right.
They just sent an email to you.
Right. You know, the other thing is that, you know, it's surprising, and we don't have to go into in depth here, but, you know, Gensler, in this conversation that I saw him at when he was on stage at that point, He talked about, you know, there was a question, why aren't these financial regulations that were supposed to be in effect a year ago, they're not even nearly completed? You know, and the whole thing is, I mean, my biggest concern is that what it looks and smells like, what happened on that turnaround earlier last week, was that it was so incredibly futures-driven because everything went up at the same time. It was like just a giant button was pushed, and it just jammed. Think about that. The ability to margin, or leverage, I should say, the ability to leverage futures contracts is unbelievable. And you have the ability to then basically just squeeze the crap out of any shorts out there with a flick of one contract to use in a multiplier fashion. And the other thing is that the ETF world has really, I think, created an absolute disaster, even though we use ETFs, in that, you know, they're talking about an aluminum ETF. Well, do we really need to raise prices on commodities because they need to be backed by actual materials or even food for that matter because they want it to be traded? There's something just out of focus and missing there.
Well, we're in a bit of a speculative bubble, I think, with ETFs. I have not traded ETFs yet, so I like to deal with the principal, not the agent, in a business transaction. And
right.
These ETFs are definitely the agents. And I suspect that there will be a day of reckoning in those because some of the points you mentioned. But they do allow the average guy to get in. You don't have to roll contracts forward. So there can be some economic advantages to them. You know, along the same line, the thing that has been so good for us is Goldman Sachs, as you know, has to roll future contracts forward for their long-only commodity funds every month.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely has an influence in the market in commodities. And you go to the website, they tell you when they're going to roll their contracts. It's all right there. You can figure out pretty much when they're going to be selling, when they're going to be buying. So you get some nice short-term pops in the market based on the Goldman roll.
Yeah, and you can also actually, if you look at, you say that the ETFs sometimes avoid the problems with the process of rolling. Go look at UNG, probably one of the worst ever funds out there. And the only one really available for natural gas, and how the differential between natural gas pricing and the actual fund's performance over time has been, it's enormous because they kept on getting hit with contango and then rolls.
Yeah.
It was terrible. Anyway, we move on. What other major things are really should, you know, investors and people know about right now? And I know that you also teach and you have classes and I guess mentoring and things of that nature. I'm on your... Oh, there's the Goldman Roll right on your website, actually. You got Larry TV. Cool. LWU.
Hey, Larry TV is something I do once a week or about once a week where I get my setup trades I have, what I'm looking for. I kind of was interested in buying unleaded gasoline, which I went long last night. And we usually spot those in advance on Larry TV.
Mm-hmm.
I try to stay active, but today's my 69th birthday. I'm not as active as I was.
69?
69.
Wow. You don't sound a day over 65.
Yeah, well, that's Skype for you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Larry, I got to tell you something. You know, you've been trading a long time, and this time is different. Let's just throw out the window because it's really never different. But it's something a little bit, I don't know, the market's the same as you remember them way back. I mean, obviously they're not exactly, but I mean, is this something kind of fundamentally different now?
Yes, there is. The big change is not having pit sessions. I would kill if we could go back to pit sessions. Because it takes care of the problems of the news of an increase in the silver margin because you have an overnight for something to work itself out emotionally. Now we close the market, it opens 20 minutes later, it trades around the clock. You have a no man's land when nobody's trading it, so at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, stop and rob trader comes in and shoots people in the, you know.
Yeah, the 2 a.m. bandit. There he is.
Yeah. So pit sessions to me were a beautiful thing in retrospect. I do get a little better fills now, though, in the electronic markets than I did in pit session markets. And I can do it without using a broker. I mean, I haven't talked to my broker, but maybe, I don't know, I've talked to him this year. I'll have to give him a call.
Yeah.
So parts of that can be easier. But certainly we have more people trading, which means more people are trading based on news, because most people don't have a clue. They don't know the stuff you publish. They don't know the stuff I publish. So they're clueless.
Mm-hmm.
So they're banking on emotions, on news, and what they heard from, you know, their banker or whatever. So it's a very emotional-driven market, more now because we have more emotional traders in the market. Clueless traders, if you will.
Yeah, no, it's interesting also because I do think that the news flow and the recent, very recently, the movement of markets by, I don't know, 1%. Can you imagine years ago, the market moving 1% was like, wow, that's pretty good. That's wow, right?
If soybeans went up 50 cents in a year, it was a phenomenal bull market.
Right. So, you know, and now it's like, Trichet just tripped over a rock, and oh my God, there go the markets. You know what I mean? It's quite incredible how the movement, and you know, you're talking 10, 20, 30 basis points movements in things in a snap. It's almost like the old days when there was spreads that were wide, you know, and not only spreads. You know,
part of that is the speed of news. When I started trading in 1962, if we got the Wall Street Journal, it was maybe 3 or 4 or 5 days late.
Nice.
It didn't matter. It was still good news. But now the news is instantaneous.
Yeah.
It's boom. And you have emotional players in the market. And so they go, oh, and they're clueless. Like, you know, Steve Jobs died. This is like when Walt Disney died. As far as I'm concerned, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an analogy between those two companies. So
right.
You go, okay, well, what did Disney do when Disney died? What's going to happen to this company? So most people don't have the emotional perspective. They listen to news, and you know, you can't trade off news. I think it is mostly wrong most all the time.
So, when you set up your trades, and I know we're taking up a lot of time and doing some stuff, but it's so great to talk to you. When you set up a trade and you're looking at, you know, kind of downside risk and upside opportunity. Now, I know when we're talking about some of the things that, like futures and all that, that's obviously a lot quicker of a transaction. You know, is there any advice you can give everybody out there about, you know, where to kind of like place your levels of downside and upside?
Well, first, you have to trade with stops, because otherwise you can have large losses, and that's stocks or commodities. My stops tend to be in a futures contract $1,000 to $2,000 away. They say a day's range, maybe a day and a half range away. So I don't want them too close. I'm not good enough to call the highs and lows of the market. I give the market some breathing room, so that's really critical to me. You've got to use stops. They can't be real far away, but you have to give the market room to move back and forth,
right,
up and down.
Yeah,
just not too much, but it's critical that if you don't use stops, you're going to get blown out.
I hear you. All right, so you got things. You got CDs, libraries, got all sorts of things, and it's fun. It's interesting because I see your books and. Obviously, you've written those over the years, and you can almost see a slow motion, let's just say on your birthday, aging of Larry from all the different pictures when you started out. What was your first book? Which one did you write first?
The Secret of Selecting Stocks.
Where is that one? Let's go here. Where is that on this here? Did it have you on the picture? Oh, The Secret of Selecting Stocks for Immediate and Substantial Gains. Well, that was a very... long title. It's gonna like it though.
Yeah, I like long titles.
You know, these days they have one thing like chocolate. I mean, that's the you know, you know.
Right.
And then you have things are translated in German here. Futures Trading Guide. Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Like German, Russian, Spanish, Chinese, Japanese, Hungarian, most every major language of the world.
How you made $1 million last year trading commodities? What year was that?
The first year I did that was 1970 and then 1973.
Yeah, see, that's not so impressive now.
No, it isn't.
You know, it used to be how I made my first million last week. You know, that's what kind of it is, you know?
But
that's great. That's good stuff. Larry Williams, and you can find him over at, very simply go to ireallytrade.com. We'll put his links on our website. And I think also check out some of his weekly, the Goldman Roll that's on his website. The Larry Williams University, great trading. This is one of those people that if you can borrow some of his knowledge from over the years, I think it's going to be really great. And again, happy birthday.
Hey, thanks very much.
I appreciate it, Larry.
All right. Thanks for the opportunity today.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks much. Bye.
Well, that's going to give the show a wrap, as they say, and we're going to have to end it there. Ran a little bit later than we like. We usually have about an hour, a little bit longer today. And we are going to be back next week with some exciting things, and we will see what we're going to do to the end of the year. Because, of course, as we mentioned in the top of the show, there is a lot going on in Europe, and really, that's where all the focus is. And frankly, I hope it stays there, because we don't need any more shocks to the system. It just can't take it right now. The jobs bill? Well, I don't know if that's going to go through too well. The repatriation of assets? Oh, boy, they're going to duke it out, but let's see what happens. In the end, a lot more stalemate going on. That's what I see, at least. Thanks for joining me. Anytime you want to check out how we manage money, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you can see a quick link that will show you how to look at the virtual tour. It's a 12-minute little video that I guide you through on how we manage money. It's a $50,000 minimum. It's kind of like at that time where you're like, oh, I don't know what to do. Do I go long? Do I short? I don't even know how to short. Do I use options? I'm not sure how to do it. Well, that's what we do. So you could check that out, and we do it all so you could see it. It's out in the open. You have your own individual account, and we write a daily update, a private client update, so you can see what's happening, why we're doing it, why we're not doing it, where we did well, where we went wrong. Check it out over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.